It's the night of October 28, 2003. Mark Zuckerberg, 19 years old, sophomore at Harvard, furious about a girl, at least as depicted in The Social Network, is sitting in his dorm room in Kirkland House, one of Harvard's upper-class residential houses. He's got a blog open. He's writing in real time as he codes. The entry reads like a fever dream. Contemptuous, self-aware, a little drunk. He's building something. A website that pulls photos from the Harvard House Facebooks, the online directories of student photos, and presents them side by side, asking visitors to vote on who's more attractive.
He calls it Face Mash. By the time he goes to sleep, the thing is live. Within 4 hours, it's collected 22,000 votes from about 450 individual visitors. 4 hours. No marketing, no launch strategy, just a URL passed from room to room in the Harvard dorms like a contagion.
Harvard's administration shuts it down the next morning. Zuckerberg is hauled before the university's disciplinary board. But the number, 22,000 votes from 450 people in 4 hours on a website about people you actually know, tells him something that nobody else in Silicon Valley understands yet. Social data about real people you know is the most compelling content on the internet.
22,000 votes in 4 hours with no marketing. That's the kind of signal that VCs would kill for in a pitch deck, and it came from a drunken side project that got its creator hauled before the disciplinary board.
Welcome back to Silicon Valley Strategy. I'm Myra D'Amico.
And I'm Travis Carlisle. This is episode 12. Votes from a website that a 19-year-old coded while drunk. That number launched a trillion-dollar company, and nobody saw it coming.
And today we're doing Facebook. Or, more precisely, the first half of the Facebook story. From the dorm room to the IPO, the founding, the growth machine, the news feed, the advertising model, and the mobile crisis that almost destroyed the company.
I think this is one of those episodes where we need to be upfront about something. Facebook, Meta, is one of the most consequential companies in history, and it's also one of the most complicated to have feelings about. The product shaped how 2 billion people communicate, and the product has also been credibly accused of undermining democracy, enabling genocide in Myanmar, and worsening teen mental health. We're going to cover the business and the strategy. We're not going to pretend the externalities don't exist.
That's well said. We'll get to the externalities in part two. This episode is about the machine, how it was built, why it worked, and what made it different from every social network that came before it.
Let's start with trivia. And this one's about the moment before Facebook, the night that Zuckerberg built FaceMash.
Here's the question. FaceMash, the predecessor to Facebook, launched on October 28, 2003, and was shut down the next morning by Harvard's administration. In those few hours, how many photo views did it collect? And why did that number matter for the creation of Facebook?
If you're playing along, pause now.
The answer, 22,000 votes from approximately 450 visitors in 4 hours. The site spread through the Harvard dorms purely through word of mouth, or more precisely through AIM, AOL Instant Messenger, messages and emails between students. Nobody promoted it. Nobody had to. The content was inherently viral because it was about people you knew.
And the reason the number matters is that it told Zuckerberg something quantitative about demand. He wasn't guessing that people wanted social information about their real-world peers. He had data. 22,000 data points. In 4 hours. On a campus of 6,700 undergraduates. That's an engagement rate that would make any product manager weep with envy.
The insight wasn't, people want to rate each other's attractiveness. The insight was, people are irresistibly drawn to information about people they actually know. Real names, real photos, real social context. That insight became the Facebook 4 months later.
And it's the same insight that distinguishes Facebook from every social network that preceded it. Friendster used real names but didn't tie to a real-world social institution. MySpace was pseudonymous. Your identity was your username, your page design, your music. Facebook said, you are your real name, your real school, your real face. and that was different.
Let's set the stage. What does the social internet look like in early 2004?
The landscape is chaotic. Friendster launched in 2002 and briefly became the hottest site on the internet. Millions of users, enormous press coverage. But Friendster has a catastrophic technical problem. The site is slow, like unbelievably slow. Page loads take 30 seconds. The servers can't handle the traffic. Users are abandoning Friendster in waves because the product literally doesn't work at the speed of human attention.
And into that vacuum comes MySpace, which launches in 2003. MySpace solves the speed problem. The site actually loads and adds customization. You can put music on your profile, you can customize your page with HTML. It's the GeoCities of social networking. MySpace grows explosively. By early 2004, it has millions of users and is clearly the dominant social network in the United States.
So, the conventional wisdom in early 2004 is social networking is a solved problem. MySpace won. The space is occupied. There's no room for another entrant. This is important context for understanding how the Facebook was perceived when it launched. It wasn't seen as a MySpace competitor. It was seen as a niche campus directory for elite colleges.
And that misperception was, in retrospect, Facebook's greatest strategic advantage because nobody felt threatened by a campus directory. Same pattern as Intel in the early days. Nobody at Fairchild or IBM thought a small chip company in Santa Clara was going to reshape computing. The best competitive advantages start in the blind spot.
The other piece of context is the advertising market. In 2004, Google is dominant in search advertising. The AdWords model of pay-per-click is generating billions in revenue. But display advertising, banner ads, the kind of advertising that would make sense on a social network, is a low CPM commodity business. Nobody's figured out how to make social networking as profitable as search.
Because the intent signal is different. When you search Google for buy running shoes, Google knows you want to buy running shoes. That's high-value intent. When you're browsing your friend's MySpace page, what's your intent? To look at photos, to read a blog post, to listen to a song. There's no purchase signal. The advertising targeting is blunt. Demographics and page context, basically. And the CPMs reflect that.
The question that hangs over every social network in 2004 is, how do you make money? Friendster never figured it out. MySpace was acquired by News Corp for $580 million in 2005, and News Corp struggled to monetize it. Facebook would eventually answer this question in a way that changed the entire advertising industry. But in 2004, the answer isn't obvious.
And one more piece of context. Mobile doesn't exist yet, not in any meaningful sense. The iPhone won't ship until 2007. In 2004, the internet is a desktop experience. You sit down at a computer, you open a browser, you navigate to a website. The idea that you'd carry the internet in your pocket and check it 200 times a day is science fiction. Facebook is built for a world of desktop browsers and dorm room Ethernet connections. That'll matter enormously later.
The Facebook, with the, launches on February 4, 2004. It's available only to Harvard students. You must have a harvard.edu email address to register. The product is Spartan, a profile page with your photo, your name, your concentration, your year, your dorm, your relationship status. No customization, no music, no HTML. Just information about a real person in a real social context.
And here's the thing that still blows my mind about the launch. Zuckerberg coded the first version of the Facebook in his dorm room in about 2 weeks. Not months, not a semester-long project, 2 weeks. And within 24 hours of going live, over 1,200 Harvard students had signed up. 1,200 people in one day on a product with zero marketing, zero advertising, zero promotion of any kind.
Hold on. 1,200 signups in 24 hours on a campus of 6,700? That's nearly 20% of the school in a single day. I want everyone to sit with that number because it's one of the most extraordinary organic adoption metrics in the history of consumer technology. No paid acquisition, no growth hacks, just a URL circulating through dorm room conversations and AIM windows. The product was its own distribution channel.
By the end of the first month, half the undergraduate population had a profile. Half. And nobody had to be convinced. They heard about it from a friend, they checked it out, they signed up, the social graph was pulling them in.
And that's the thing that makes this different from every previous social network. The constraint, Harvard only, isn't a limitation. It's the product. Because when you see a profile on the Facebook, you know the person is a real Harvard student. The harvard.edu email verification is a trust mechanism. You're not interacting with anonymous strangers or pseudonymous avatars. You're interacting with people who sit in the same dining hall as you, people you've seen in lecture, people your roommate knows. The social graph is real world, verified, and dense.
And that density is the key to understanding why the network effects were so explosive. In social graph theory, a network's value isn't just a function of how many people are on it. It's a function of how connected those people are to each other. A network of 1,000 strangers is much less valuable than a network of 1,000 people who all know each other. Harvard's social graph was pre-existing and dense. Everyone already knew everyone, or knew someone who knew them. The Facebook didn't create the social graph. It digitized a social graph that already existed. And digitizing a dense, pre-existing graph produces network effects that are qualitatively different from building a graph from scratch.
That's the real name advantage in a nutshell. MySpace had more users than Facebook for years. Didn't matter, because MySpace connections were pseudonymous. Strangers with cool usernames, people you'd never met. Facebook connections were real friendships, real classmates, real social obligations. The network with fewer but higher quality nodes produced more value per node. And that value differential is what made the network effect compound so violently.
What gets me about this moment is the simplicity. Zuckerberg doesn't have a business plan. He doesn't have revenue projections. He doesn't have a pitch deck. He has a product that solves a problem every college student has. Who is that person in my economics class? Are they single? What dorm do they live in? Who do we know in common? These are questions that human beings have always wanted answered, and the Facebook answers them instantly.
The expansion is methodical. After Harvard, the Facebook opens to Columbia, Yale, and Stanford. Not all schools at once. Specific schools, one at a time. Each school must have enough demand, measured by petition volume, before the Facebook opens there. This creates artificial scarcity. Students at schools that don't have it yet hear about it from friends at schools that do. The demand builds before the supply arrives.
And the expansion strategy itself is a growth hack. By limiting access to specific schools, Facebook creates FOMO. Students at UC Berkeley are hearing about the Facebook from their friends at Stanford, and they can't get access. When it finally opens at Berkeley, the adoption is immediate because the demand has been building for weeks. That's the network effect being weaponized. The scarcity makes the network more desirable. And the desirability accelerates adoption once the gates open.
Sean Parker enters the picture in the summer of 2004. Parker is 24 years old. He co-founded Napster at 19. He's been fired from Plaxo, the contact management startup. He is, by most accounts, charismatic, erratic, and strategically brilliant. He meets Zuckerberg through a mutual connection and immediately understands what the Facebook is becoming.
Parker convinces Zuckerberg to move the company to Silicon Valley for the summer. Parker convinces him to drop "the" from the name. It becomes just Facebook. And Parker's most important contribution, I think, is philosophical. He tells Zuckerberg, "This isn't a campus tool. This is a company. And not just a company. This is the company. The one that maps the social graph of the entire world."
Parker connects Zuckerberg to Peter Thiel, the PayPal co-founder and investor, who writes the first significant outside check, $500,000 for approximately 10% of the company. Thiel's thesis is straightforward and grounded in social graph theory. Facebook has the network effect. Every new user makes the product more valuable for every existing user. In network effect businesses, the winner takes most or all of the market. If Facebook is the winner, the upside is enormous. And the real name policy, the structural decision that every profile is a verified real person, is what makes the network effect defensible. Because a real identity network is harder to replicate than a pseudonymous one. You can't just copy the features, you have to copy the relationships.
And Thiel is right. But the path from that $500,000 check to the winner-take-all outcome isn't smooth. It's a decade-long war for attention, distribution, and monetization.
September 5th, 2006, Facebook launches the newsfeed, and it nearly destroys the company.
Let me set up what the newsfeed actually changed. Before the newsfeed, Facebook is a collection of profile pages. If you want to see what your friend is doing, you go to their profile page. You check it manually, it's a pull model, you have to go find the information.
The newsfeed inverts this. Instead of you going to your friends' profiles, the newsfeed brings your friends' activity to you. In one scrollable stream, you see everything: status updates, photo uploads, relationship changes, new friendships, event RSVPs. The algorithm decides what to show you and in what order. It's a push model. The information comes to you.
And the reaction is immediate and violently negative. A protest group called Students Against Facebook Newsfeed forms within hours. It gains over 700,000 members in days, making it, ironically, one of the largest groups ever created on Facebook. The complaint is that Facebook is now stalking its users. Information that you posted on your profile, expecting that someone would have to deliberately visit your page to see it. Your relationship status, your photos, your activities, is now being broadcast to everyone in your network automatically.
The press covers it as a disaster. The narrative is Zuckerberg has made a catastrophic product mistake. Users are revolting. Facebook needs to roll back the newsfeed.
And here's the moment that defines Zuckerberg as a founder. He doesn't roll it back. He adds privacy controls, gives users the ability to choose what appears in the newsfeed and what doesn't. But he doesn't remove the feature. He holds firm. And within weeks, the engagement data makes it obvious that he was right. Time on site skyrockets. Daily active usage increases dramatically. The people who are protesting the newsfeed are, by every measurable metric, using Facebook more than they did before the newsfeed existed.
700,000 people joined a Facebook group to protest Facebook, using Facebook. The irony is so thick you could cut it with a knife.
That alone should have told them the product was working.
Right? The protest is the proof of concept.
Exactly. We hate this product so much that we're going to use it intensively to tell you how much we hate it.
Here's the thing that's analytically interesting. The users said they hated it. The users' behavior said they loved it. Zuckerberg trusted the behavior over the words. And that decision to trust engagement data over expressed preference became a core operating principle at Facebook, one that would produce extraordinary growth and eventually extraordinary controversy.
I want to sit with that tension for a second. Because trust engagement data over expressed preference is a defensible product philosophy when the stakes are, do people like seeing their friends' photos in a feed? It becomes a much more dangerous philosophy when the stakes are, is this platform amplifying misinformation and radicalizing users? The same principle that made the newsfeed a product success made it, arguably, a social failure. But we'll get to that in part two.
Agreed. For now, the newsfeed is the inflection point. Before the newsfeed, Facebook is a directory. After the newsfeed, Facebook is a media consumption platform. And that transformation is what makes the advertising model possible, because now there's a feed to put ads in. The newsfeed doesn't just change the user experience, it creates the business model. Let me jump forward to 2009, because two things happen in 2009 that are foundational to everything that follows.
The like button.
The like button. Facebook introduces the like button in February 2009. It seems trivial. A small thumbs up icon that lets you indicate approval of a post with a single click. No need to write a comment. No need to compose a thought. Just click.
But the like button isn't a product feature. It's a data collection mechanism disguised as a product feature. Every like generates a signal. It tells Facebook, this person likes this type of content. This person has this preference. This person engages with this topic. Multiply that by hundreds of millions of users clicking like dozens of times a day, and you've got the most granular behavioral data set ever assembled.
Hold on. I need everyone to appreciate the elegance of this. People are literally volunteering their preferences with enthusiasm. Nobody made them do it. They wanted to. Facebook didn't have to scrape this data or infer it from behavior. Users handed it over happily because clicking like feels good. It's the most elegant data collection mechanism ever designed.
And that dataset is what makes Facebook's advertising targeting possible. Before the like button, Facebook's ad targeting was demographic: age, gender, location, school. After the like button, Facebook's ad targeting is behavioral: what you actually care about, what you actually engage with, what predicts your purchasing behavior. The resolution of the targeting goes from standard definition to high definition overnight.
And the user provides the data voluntarily, eagerly even. People like things because it feels good. It's a micro expression of identity. I like this band, I like this movie, I like this cause. Every like is simultaneously a social performance and a data point. The user gets the social performance. Facebook gets the data point.
Amazon had to build an entire advertising infrastructure from scratch. Facebook got the data for free by inventing a button that feels like a compliment. That's wild. That might be the purest cornered resource play in this entire series, a data asset that users build for you voluntarily because they enjoy doing it.
Wait, say that again. A cornered resource that the customers build for you. That's exactly what it is. And no competitor can replicate it because the data is proprietary and the network that generates it is locked in by the social graph's network effects. Two powers reinforcing each other through a single UI element. The network effects keep users on the platform. The users generate the data. The data makes the advertising better. The advertising funds the product. The product strengthens the network effects. It's a flywheel built on a thumbs-up icon.
A thumbs-up icon worth hundreds of billions of dollars.
Now, the mobile crisis. Facebook goes public on May 18, 2012. IPO price $38 per share. Valuation approximately $104 billion. It's the largest technology IPO in history at that point. And within the S-1 filing, the IPO prospectus, there's an admission that should have terrified every investor in the room.
The admission: Facebook has essentially zero mobile revenue. Zero. In 2012, when smartphone adoption is exploding, when mobile internet usage is overtaking desktop usage, when the future of computing is clearly in the phone in your pocket, Facebook's mobile app has no ads, no monetization, no revenue model.
The stock craters. Within months of the IPO, Facebook shares fall below $20, nearly half the IPO price. The narrative in the press is, Facebook is a desktop company that's missed the mobile transition. The company is in genuine existential danger. If Facebook can't figure out mobile advertising, it's MySpace, a desktop social network overtaken by the platform shift.
And what happens next is, I think this is Zuckerberg's finest hour as a CEO. He declares a company-wide emergency. The internal phrase is mobile first. Every product decision, every engineering priority, every design choice is reoriented around mobile. Zuckerberg reportedly tells the engineering team that he won't review or approve any product that isn't designed for mobile first and desktop second.
I mean, this is the newsfeed decision on a company-wide scale. Trust the data about where computing is going, not the comfort of what you've already built. Same founder instinct, higher stakes.
Much higher stakes. His net worth is cratering in real time.
The turnaround is remarkable. Facebook's mobile advertising product ships in 2012. The newsfeed, which translates beautifully to a mobile scrolling experience because it's already a linear infinite scroll format, becomes the primary mobile advertising surface. By 2013, mobile advertising is a significant and rapidly growing percentage of revenue. By 2014, mobile is the majority of Facebook's advertising revenue.
The stock recovers, then it surpasses the IPO price, then it keeps going. By 2014, Facebook stock is trading at $70, nearly double the IPO price. The mobile crisis isn't just resolved, it transforms Facebook from a desktop social network into a mobile advertising machine.
And the advertising model itself is fundamentally different from Google's. Google's advertising is intent-based. The user searches for something, revealing purchase intent, and the advertiser pays to appear in the results. Facebook's advertising is interest-based and demographic-based. The user reveals preferences through their behavior: likes, shares, time spent, topics engaged with, and the advertiser targets people who match a behavioral profile.
The way I think about it, Google captures demand. Facebook creates demand. If you already know you want running shoes, you search Google. If you don't know you want running shoes yet, but you're in the demographic that buys running shoes and you've engaged with fitness content, Facebook puts the ad in your feed. These are two fundamentally different advertising models addressing two different parts of the purchase funnel.
And the market is large enough for both. Google and Facebook, together, by 2020, capture approximately 50 to 60% of all digital advertising spend in the United States. The duopoly, two companies, two different models, both enormously profitable, both built on data about user behavior, both protected by different powers, Google by scale economies and search infrastructure, Facebook by the social graph's network effects. Speaking of network effects, we built a 70-year interactive timeline in the course that maps every technology wave and how the companies overlap. You can see exactly when Facebook launched relative to MySpace, Friendster, the iPhone, all of it. The course is at svstrategy.xyz, SV, short for Silicon Valley, strategy.xyz. It's the kind of thing you lose an hour in, so we've been weaving the powers into the story as they appeared. The network economies at launch, the cornered resource in the like button data, the counterpositioning against Google. Let me now pull back and look at the full picture because Facebook demonstrates how powers layer on top of each other over time.
Start with the one that's been present since day one.
Network economies. Facebook is one of the purest examples of direct network effects in business history. Every additional user increases the value of the network for every existing user. If your friends are on Facebook, Facebook is valuable to you. If your friends aren't on Facebook, Facebook is worthless to you. The product's value is entirely a function of who else is on it.
And this creates a winner-take-most dynamic, because network effects tip. Once one social network in a given social context reaches critical mass, once enough of your friends are there, switching to a competing network is painful. You'd have to convince your entire social graph to switch with you. The coordination cost is enormous. And the density of the real name graph makes this even stickier. These aren't anonymous follows you can rebuild anywhere. These are verified real-world relationships that took years to accumulate.
This is exactly what killed Friendster and MySpace as competitors. Friendster had the technology problem. The site was too slow. MySpace had the identity problem. Pseudonymous users, spam, an increasingly chaotic user experience. But the reason users left those platforms and came to Facebook, specifically, was that their real-world friends were moving to Facebook. The network effect pulled them.
But I want to push back on the winner-take-all framing. Because Twitter exists, LinkedIn exists, Snapchat exists, Instagram existed as an independent company. These are all social networks that coexist with Facebook. So is it really winner-take-all?
It's winner-take-all within a given social context. Facebook won the real identity social graph, your actual friends and family. LinkedIn won the professional network. Twitter won the public conversation graph. Snapchat carved out the ephemeral messaging niche. These are different social contexts with different use cases. Within each context, network effects do create winner-take-most dynamics. But across contexts, multiple networks can coexist.
That's an important distinction. The network effect is context-specific. Not social networking is winner-take-all. But the real identity social graph is winner-take-all. And the real name policy, the structural decision Zuckerberg made at founding, is what defined the context Facebook would win.
Second power switching costs. Your social graph on Facebook, your friends, your photos, your messages, your groups, your events, your memories, is extraordinarily sticky. To leave Facebook, you're not just leaving a product, you're leaving your social connections. You're losing access to the birthday reminders, the event invitations, the group conversations, the photo albums. The switching cost isn't technical. It's social and emotional.
And this is why the just quit Facebook argument has always been naive. Yeah, you can quit. But quitting isn't free. Quitting means missing your cousin's wedding announcement, your college roommate's baby photos, the neighborhood group where people post about local events. The switching cost is measured in relationships, not features.
Third power, scale economies on the data side. Facebook's advertising targeting improves with more data. More users generate more behavioral data. More behavioral data enables more precise targeting. More precise targeting produces better return on ad spend for advertisers. Better ROI attracts more advertising dollars. More revenue funds more product development. The data flywheel is a scale economy because the marginal value of each additional data point increases as the data set grows.
And the fourth power, the counterpositioning against Google. In 2010-2011, Google is watching Facebook grow and is terrified. Facebook has something Google doesn't, the social graph. Google knows what you search for. Facebook knows who you are, who your friends are, what you care about, and how you spend your time. That social data is enormously valuable for advertising, and Google has no organic source of it.
Which is why Google launched Google Plus in 2011. The explicit goal was to build a competing social graph, and it failed comprehensively. Not because the product was bad. Google Plus was actually a reasonably well-designed social network. It failed because of the network effect. Your friends were already on Facebook. Google Plus was an empty room. You could build the most beautiful room in the world, but if nobody you know is there, you're not going to stay.
And this is the thing I love about this as a case study. Google had unlimited resources, unlimited engineering talent, unlimited distribution through Gmail and search. And it still didn't matter. You can't brute force a social graph into existence. The network economy is the one power that money can't buy. Google couldn't write a check large enough to replicate 1,200 organic signups in 24 hours from people who actually knew each other. That density of real-world connection, the thing that the real name policy created, is what made the network defensible.
That should humble every founder and every investor who thinks capital alone can solve the cold start problem.
Google's failure with Google Plus is actually a perfect illustration of counterpositioning. Facebook's social graph couldn't be replicated by Google because Google had no organic mechanism for acquiring social data. Google had search intent data. Google had email data from Gmail. But Google didn't have the social graph, the map of who your friends are and what they do, because that data is created through social interaction, and social interaction was happening on Facebook, not on Google.
For Google to acquire the social graph, it would have had to get hundreds of millions of people to voluntarily rebuild their social connections on a new platform. The cost of customer acquisition for a social network isn't just dollars. It's the coordination cost of moving an entire network simultaneously. And that cost exceeded any benefit Google could offer. Two frameworks from this story. Framework one, social graph versus interest graph. This distinction is critical for understanding why different social networks succeed and fail.
Lay it out.
A social graph is a map of real-world relationships. Who are your friends? Who are your family members? Who'd you go to school with? Who do you work with? The edges in the graph represent actual human relationships. Facebook is a social graph. LinkedIn is a professional social graph. The content you see is a function of who you know.
And an interest graph.
An interest graph is a map of what you care about, not who you know, what you follow, what you engage with, what topics attract your attention. Twitter is an interest graph. Reddit is an interest graph. YouTube's recommendation algorithm builds an interest graph. The content you see is a function of what you like, not who you know.
And the strategic implication is that these are different businesses with different competitive dynamics.
Exactly. Social graphs have enormous switching costs because your relationships are on the platform. Interest graphs have lower switching costs because your interests travel with you. I can follow the same topics on Twitter that I follow on Blue Sky. The content might be different, but the interest graph is portable. I can't take my 800 Facebook friends and their photos and their message history to a new platform. The social graph is locked in.
Which is why Facebook has been more durable than Twitter. The moat is deeper because the switching cost is higher.
But here's where I want to complicate the framework. TikTok is neither a social graph nor a traditional interest graph. TikTok is an algorithmically generated content feed where the algorithm determines what you see based on behavioral signals, what you watch, how long you watch, what you skip, with almost no reliance on social connections. You don't need to follow anyone for TikTok to work. This is a third model, the algorithmic graph, and it turns out to be enormously compelling.
And threatening to Facebook, which is why Facebook built Reels. But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
We'll get to TikTok, but I just want to flag the algorithmic graph is to the social graph what AWS was to on-premise servers. A fundamentally different paradigm that makes the old model's advantages irrelevant.
Whoa, that's a strong comparison. We'll see if it holds.
I'm planting a flag. We'll come back to it.
Framework 2, real identity as network effect amplifier. This is the specific insight that made Facebook different from MySpace. On MySpace, your identity was a creation, your username, your page design, your song. On Facebook, your identity was yourself, your real name, your real photo, your real school. The real identity constraint does two things. First, it increases trust. You know that the person you're interacting with is who they say they are. Second, it amplifies the network effect. Because the person on Facebook is your actual friend, not a stranger with a cool username, the value of the connection is higher. The network effect scales with the quality of the connections, not just the quantity. MySpace had more users than Facebook for years, and it didn't matter, because MySpace connections were lower quality. Pseudonymous, often strangers, less trust. Facebook connections were real friendships. The network with fewer but higher quality nodes produced more value per node. And this is the structural advantage that 1,200 signups in 24 hours revealed. Every one of those 1,200 people knew other people who had signed up. The graph was pre-wired. The real name policy didn't just create trust. It connected Facebook to the densest social graph available, the one that already existed in the real world.
And I think this generalizes. When you're building a network, the quality of the connections matters more than the quantity. A network of 50 million real identity connections is more valuable, more defensible, more engaging, more monetizable than a network of 200 million pseudonymous connections.
I want to push back a little, because pseudonymous networks have their own strengths. Reddit works because people are pseudonymous. They share things they'd never share under their real names. The content is more honest, more raw, more useful in certain contexts.
Fair. The real identity advantage is specifically about social networking, about mapping and leveraging real-world relationships. For content-driven communities, pseudonymity has genuine benefits. The framework isn't real identity is always better. The framework is real identity amplifies social network effects specifically.
Agreed. What does a founder or investor take from the Facebook story?
First lesson, the newsfeed decision. Zuckerberg launched a feature that users vocally hated, and he trusted the engagement data over the vocal minority. This is a specific and replicable strategic insight. Users will often protest a change that, by every behavioral metric, makes the product more engaging. The reason is that expressed preferences and revealed preferences are different things. People say they want privacy. People's behavior says they want to know what their friends are doing. The founder who trusts revealed preference over expressed preference will often make the right product decision.
But, and this is where I want to be careful, that principle has limits. Because trust engagement data can become optimized for engagement at all costs, which can become amplify outrage because outrage drives engagement, which can become destabilize democracy because destabilizing content is engaging. The principle is valid, but it needs guardrails.
I don't disagree. The principle is a tool, not a religion.
Second lesson, the mobile pivot. Facebook was a desktop company that had to become a mobile company in approximately 12 months or die. Zuckerberg's willingness to declare an emergency, reorient the entire engineering organization, and subordinate every other priority to mobile. That's what separating the great CEOs from the good ones looks like. It's not a gradual strategy. It's a wartime decision.
And the structural reason the pivot succeeded is that the newsfeed, Facebook's core product, was inherently suited to mobile. A vertical, scrollable feed of content is the natural interaction pattern for a phone screen. Facebook didn't have to reinvent its product for mobile. It had to adapt the form factor. If the core product had been something less mobile native, say, a desktop-centric design like MySpace's customizable pages, the pivot would have been much harder.
Which suggests a general principle. The products that survive platform transitions are the ones whose core interaction pattern translates to the new platform. The newsfeed translated from desktop to mobile because scrolling is platform agnostic. MySpace's customizable HTML pages didn't translate because they were inherently desktop.
And the third lesson, the one I think about most often, is about the advertising model. Facebook proved that interest-based and demographic targeting, powered by behavioral data, is a viable alternative to intent-based targeting. Before Facebook, the conventional wisdom was that only search advertising, Google-style, intent-based, could generate premium CPMs. Facebook proved that if you have enough behavioral data, you can create demand, not just capture it. And creating demand is a larger addressable market than capturing demand, because the universe of people who don't yet know they want something is much larger than the universe of people who are actively searching for something.
That's the insight that made Facebook a $100 billion revenue company. Not capturing demand, creating it.
And I want to flag one more thing before we leave the strategy section, because it's going to matter enormously in part two. While the consumer product gets all the attention, Facebook is quietly making infrastructure decisions in this era that reveal a completely different strategic playbook. In 2011, Facebook launches the Open Compute Project. They open source their data center designs. The actual blueprints for how they build their servers and cooling systems, they give it away for free.
Wait, they open source their data centers? That feels counterintuitive. Why would you give away your infrastructure advantage?
Because it's not an advantage you lose by sharing. It's an advantage you multiply. If the entire industry adopts your data center design standards, the supply chain optimizes around your specifications. The hardware you need gets cheaper. The talent pool that understands your architecture gets deeper. You're commoditizing the layer beneath you to strengthen the layer you actually compete on, which is the software and the social graph.
That's the Gates playbook from the Microsoft episode. Commoditize the complement.
Exactly. And then in 2016, Facebook open sources PyTorch, their AI framework. Again, giving away the tools. And the same logic applies. If every AI researcher in the world builds on PyTorch, every AI breakthrough is one step closer to being deployable on Facebook's infrastructure. The ecosystem learns your tools. The talent pipeline speaks your language.
And this matters for part two, because when we get to Llama, Meta's open source large language model, the reaction from the industry was, why would they give away the model? As if it were some sudden, reckless decision. But the Llama open source strategy is the same playbook Meta has been running since 2011. Open compute, PyTorch, Llama, 12 years of the same strategic pattern. Commoditize the complement, grow the ecosystem, compete on the layer you control. It's not reactive, it's not desperate, it's the most consistent infrastructure strategy in big tech.
We'll get deep into Llama in part two, but I wanted to plant that flag here because the seeds of Meta's AI strategy were planted years before anyone was talking about foundation models.
Takeaways, you first.
My first takeaway is about the network effect as moat. Facebook's social graph is the deepest moat in consumer technology. Google tried to replicate it with Google Plus and failed. No other company has succeeded in building a competing real identity social graph at scale. The reason is that the social graph has a coordination cost to switch. You need your friends to switch with you. And that coordination cost increases as the network grows. The bigger Facebook gets, the harder it is to leave. This is the purest form of network economy lock-in, and we've seen it echo through every company this series, from the telephone network effects at Bell to the developer ecosystems at Intel and Apple. But Facebook's version is the stickiest because it's built on human relationships, not professional tools.
And the implication for founders is, if you're building a social product, the single most important strategic question is whether your network effects are based on social connections or content. Social connection-based network effects are stickier, but harder to bootstrap. Content-based network effects are easier to bootstrap, but less defensible. Facebook bootstrapped the hard kind by starting with a pre-existing dense graph at Harvard, where 1,200 people signed up in a day because they already knew each other. That's the cheat code. Don't build the graph. Digitize one that already exists.
My second takeaway is about the like button as data infrastructure. The like button looks like a product feature. It's actually a data collection mechanism, a cornered resource that users build for you. The most successful consumer technology companies are the ones that find ways to turn user behavior into monetizable data signals, and to do so in a way that users voluntarily participate in. The like button is the most elegant example of this pattern. The user gets social validation, the company gets behavioral data, both parties believe they're getting the better end of the deal. That alignment, where the user's incentive to engage generates the company's incentive to monetize, is the foundation of the attention economy.
My first takeaway is about Zuckerberg as a founder. I keep thinking about the contrast between the 19-year-old who built FaceMash in a night of drunken anger and the CEO who navigated the mobile crisis in 2012. The same person, 8 years apart. The growth is extraordinary. Most 19-year-olds who build something viral don't become great CEOs. Most great CEOs didn't build something viral at 19.
Zuckerberg is the rare case of someone who had both the founding instinct, the ability to see what people want before they know they want it, and the operational capacity to scale that instinct into a global business. Whether you like him or not, the combination is remarkable. My second takeaway is personal. I keep coming back to the 1200 number. 1200 signups in 24 hours. That's the signal. That's the data point that told the world, if anyone had been paying attention, that the real name social graph was the most powerful network topology on the internet. Not the biggest, not the most feature-rich, the most dense. And density in network theory is what creates the tipping point that makes a network unassailable. Pay attention to the signal, not the wrapping. FaceMash was gross. The insight it revealed was worth $500 billion.
Through line two. The social graph is an ecosystem that creates value through connections, not content. And through line four, sequenced leverage. Harvard to Ivy League, to all colleges, to everyone. Each expansion locked in the network before opening the next gate.
And if you want to go deeper on network effects and how they show up across every company we cover, the course has a full 7 powers breakdown for each one, plus AI-powered voice roleplay scenarios where you argue strategy in real time. svstrategy.exyz. svstrategy.xyz.
Next time on the show, Facebook Part 2, The Acquisition Machine. Instagram, WhatsApp, the $40 billion antitrust question, Cambridge Analytica, the meta pivot, and whether the most powerful social company in history is building the future or running from the present.
That one's going to get heated.
It's going to get heated. We'll see you then.
Bring your opinions. We're going to need them.